We are making space for analysis on the House January 6th committee here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The seventh hearing zoomed in on a December 18th six-hour meeting that a White House aide called unhinged with advisors to President Donald Trump after he lost the election, and then evidence of coordination between far-right groups and Trump allies leading up to the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. Join in on the hearings you've watched this summer, the testimony that stands out to you, the Electoral College vote, Trump allies who told him there was no proof of election fraud. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andra Gillespie is here, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta. Andra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So let's take stock for a moment, because we know now the basic outline of January 6th. The House committee is ultimately trying to make its case that it is Donald Trump who is responsible for the deadly attack on the Capitol. And from what you've seen through these summer hearings, how is it doing at this job?
I think it's actually done a pretty good job of doing two things. One, it is showing that President Trump's rhetoric inflamed the crowd, that it, you know, incited a mob that rushed towards the Capitol. I think yesterday was pretty effective in doing that. And then second, there's also the issue of planning and coordination. Trump and his allies would have people believe that they had nothing to do with not just rhetorically, but also logistically with organizing people so that they could be in position to storm the Capitol. And a lot of the evidence that was shown yesterday showed that, President Trump was at the center of planning, that they were planning secret elements of the Stop the Steal rally that were going to end in the Capitol, and that President Trump was actually very, very aware of that.
One person, as you say, the planning and the rhetoric that inflamed the mob, Stephen Ayers basically saying, look, I came to Washington because President Trump told me to do so. Former President Trump told me to do so. I mean, I think that was a really powerful moment.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that his delivery was actually very, very effective. So you have somebody who's a regular person, somebody who you could, know at your union hall, somebody who you could pass in the grocery store, who was basically telling you his story and just sort of very honestly and in a very plain spoken tone of voice, just, citing the facts of here's why I did it. And I think he's standing in for a lot of people. I think it's also important that in particular for Ayers, he wasn't affiliated with any anti-government, right-wing militia, white supremacist or nationalist group. And so he represented just the type of regular person who was caught up in the frenzy that Trump and his allies were fomenting on social media to come down, and how they could easily get caught up into something that they hadn't planned on doing.
We learned the anatomy of this chaotic December 18th meeting over how far to challenge the election results. And this was a 6-hour meeting in the White House. And they, we got descriptions by the aides and lawyers fighting over whether the election was stolen. What was significant about going deeply into this meeting?
There were a number of things. So, I think one of the surprising things for me, and I can't say that much has surprised me about the things that I've heard in the hearings, but one of the things that really shocked me yesterday was the idea that that meeting was unannounced and that Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani could just walk into the White House. From a protocol standpoint, from a security and safety standpoint, even if people are known quantities, they shouldn't have that type of access to the Oval Office. Like, they should be stopped at the ground if you don't have an appointment to be there, if you're not a regular employee. So I have all kinds of questions about how the Trump administration operated. And for the former president's safety, like, that's not a good thing. And then there are the questions about what was coming up and the idea that they were having secret meetings. Again, there's a protocol issue here, not having staff present to carry notes. There are public records requirements in terms of, you know, being able to document the things that happened in the White House. And then the shouting back and forth, was less than decorous based on what we saw, based on what we saw in all of the testimony. And I mean, you could even still see it when you saw Sidney Powell's testimony. And the idea that there would be an attempt to install her as the special prosecutor. From an optic standpoint, we've heard a lot over, the course of these hearings about how things are one-sided, with, Democrats being kind of the dominant voice in these hearings. But this sort of points out sort of like how that's a straw man argument, because if there really was a plan, an attempt, however well-formed or poorly formed it was, to put in Sidney Powell as the special counsel on this particular issue, right? Like, that also optically says you're not actually looking for truth. You're actually looking for somebody to just endorse a particular point of view.
Talking about the hearings investigating the January 6th insurrection with Andra Gillespie as our guide, associate professor of political science at Emory University. You can join in on what you have found interesting, confusing, your reaction to yesterday or the previous hearings, 800-642-1234. The committee argued that a tweet from Trump on then December 19th prompted these extremist groups to start planning the insurrection. Do you think the committee effectively made this case, specifically, going into this tweet?
The tweet in and of itself might not be the most important. It is the reaction afterwards. So I think the thing that was most compelling there were the YouTube clips, the clips from people's shows. So you have people like Alex Jones and others saying, okay, the president said, on December 19th, come on January 6th. And I think, probably the thing that was most compelling was the person, I think it was the representative from Women for Trump, who had planned a rally or after the inauguration that I would have likened to what happened with the women's marches in 2017, changing the date in her application request for a permit to January 6th after the fact. So I think that actually did provide a really strong causal case that activists and organizers in that community were taking their cues from Donald Trump and adjusting their plans, even if they had already planned on converging on Washington at some point to protest the election results.
The committee also heard from two former Oath Keepers. The Oath Keepers are one of the groups that allegedly organized the attack. Jason Van Tattenhoff, who said the paramilitary group's goal was armed revolution.
What it was going to be was an armed revolution. I mean, people died that day. Law enforcement officers died this day. There was a gallows set up in front of the Capitol. This could have been the spark that started a new civil war, and no one would have won there.
What was your reaction, Andra?
I have to admit, I didn't watch live, so there are parts of Van Tattenhoff's testimony that I haven't heard. One of the things that I thought that was very interesting about his testimony was, one, I mean, I think he sort of laid out what the self-interest would be for Stuart Rhodes to be involved in this, that he sought this as perhaps a way to legitimize his group that heretofore had been perceived as being on the fringe. But I think it's really important to actually tie the coordination between these militia groups, these extremist groups, to them being in coordination with people who were helping to organize the rally, who had the ear of people who were, tied to the president. And so I think that the committee made a good showing of being able to start to make those links and to just lay bare sort of like, what's motivating people. And that really this wasn't just they were emotional and it just kind of got out of hand that day, but that this was exactly what people had been planning on doing, using this as a vehicle for a violent political agenda that was, intended to remake America in a way that I think a lot of people would have issue with.
Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie, our guide to the House Select Committee that held its seventh hearing of the summer investigating the violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Bring your thoughts about these January 6th hearings, how to restore faith in government a year and a half after the deadly attack. Join in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a minute with Andra Gillespie here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We take stock as the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol wrapped up its seventh public hearing yesterday. This panel cannot bring legal charges against former President Trump, but its mission has been to investigate and report on the facts, the circumstances, and causes of his attempt to stop the peaceful transfer of power and connect his efforts to the violence that unfolded that day. Is the Select Committee accomplishing this task? 800-642-1234. Emory University political scientist Andra Gillespie with us for about nine more minutes. Andra, I want to talk about Select Committee Vice Chair Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming said that there have been efforts by Trump and others to influence or intimidate witnesses scheduled to testify.
And this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously.
Could Trump be putting himself in further legal jeopardy here?
If he's doing this, yes. I think there's a couple of questions. One, Congresswoman Cheney has alleged this more than once. And it's not just saying the same thing. There are different cases. So there was the allegation about Cassidy Hutchinson last week, and then this new allegation seems to be unrelated to Ms. Hutchinson. I think the big issue with the allegation of yesterday is that because the conversation didn't happen, because the target didn't answer the phone, it's going to be really hard to prove on that sort of piece of evidence alone that Trump intended to intimidate anybody. But it looks poorly. And then there's a larger ethical issue. So it's actually not illegal for Trump's team to be paying for the lawyers for people who are testifying. Optically, that is a problem. And ethically, I would argue that's probably not the wisest thing to be doing. And so he can't get in trouble for that. But if he or, you know, anybody who is associated or connected to Trump is, you know, calling witnesses and, you know, saying, you know, we know you're going to do a good job and tell the truth and defend us, that's not appropriate behavior. It's criminal behavior. And I think Trump and his team are exposing themselves to criminal liability by doing that. And if they keep on doing it, it just also represents a level of brazenness if these allegations prove to be true.
Something to keep an eye on there.
Position. Yeah.
Moving back for a moment to Liz Cheney, this is a vocal member of Congress who has opposed Trump, forcefully done so, stripped of a party leadership role last year for criticizing the former president. How do you view Cheney in the context of today's Republican Party?
It's weird. Ideologically speaking, she's in the mainstream. She's a solid conservative. She votes the way Republicans do almost all of the time. But she's out of step because she is not falling to the cult of personality that has built itself around Donald Trump. And she's been willing to stand up to him, even at the risk of great personal cost. Many people are expecting that she's going to lose her primary for her congressional seat next month. And what it seems that Congresswoman Cheney has chosen is she has chosen to pursue truth at all costs, and she's chosen sort of the longer view of history, that at the end of the day, it's more important to stand up to excesses, to tyranny, in this instance, because I think some of the things that have been discussed are tantamount to tyranny or an attempt to try to be tyrannical in some way and anti-democratic. And so she said, you know, that's actually worth losing my congressional seat for. So I think that's actually really admirable, that there are people who are actually willing to stand up for what they believe in, even if it costs them power. I mean, there are other people who, you know, also don't agree with the things that they've seen happen, but they've been more reticent to talk about it because they didn't necessarily want to pay the cost of losing their political position, whether it was elected or appointed.
Could she or has she swayed Republican opinion of the former president?
It doesn't look like that has happened just yet. But if she loses this race, you know, she may be in the wilderness for a period of time. But I think that there might be an opening for her to be able to come back at some point in the future. And I think ultimately, even if she never holds another political office again, I think history is going to look very favorably on her willingness to speak truth to power and to be able to even call out her own party, even when it was politically disadvantageous for her.
Talking about the hearings investigating the January 6th insurrection with Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University, you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Going back a hearing, former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson provided really electrifying testimony last month. We learned that Trump had attempted to grab the steering wheel of his presidential limo when informed he wasn't being taken to the Capitol on the day of the riot, that, you know, he knew the crowd assembled on the mall on January 6th was armed. What did you make of Hutchinson's testimony?
Let's just use the two. So the latter recollection was something that she personally witnessed. And I think that definitely kind of shows it shows his narcissism on one hand, but it also shows his, intent and that he understood what was happening and that he was okay with it. The allegation about him trying to grab the steering wheel has been in dispute. And admittedly, Hutchinson heard that secondhand from somebody else. So we'll probably need to hear more testimony from people who were directly involved in that to have a better understanding of what happened. What she did was to help set up some of the things that we saw today and that we will hear in subsequent hearings, I'm sure, was that clearly President Trump was at the center of planning this, that people in the West Wing were well aware of what was going on, that this wasn't spontaneous at all. So Hutchinson was able to provide her eyewitness testimony from the things that she saw from her vantage point as an aide to Mark Meadows. And then today or yesterday, we heard more things from people who were in the room at times when Hutchinson wasn't there. And so it just corroborated this idea that Trump was very involved in the planning of this rally and had the idea of perhaps marching into the Capitol with this band of supporters to try to influence the certification process in the election and to try to intimidate Vice President Pence into, you know, not certifying election results in some states to try to get a different election outcome.
Looking ahead here now for a moment, the committee expected to hold another hearing next week. Cheney previewed more testimony from former White House Counsel Pat Cipollone. What are you expecting as the committee moves forward?
I think it's important for us to think about these hearings as a grand jury. People have complained a lot. You know, we haven't heard the other side give their testimony. Well, in most grand jury proceedings, it's only the prosecutor that's making their case. So what they're doing is they're trying to present to the jury, and here it would be the Justice Department and Merrick Garland, that there is enough evidence that has been compiled to proceed with a criminal case against perhaps President Trump, but also other people who are heavily involved in this process who have not been charged for their role in the January 6th insurrection. And so I just expect to see more and more. You know, I've seen what I think is a lot of really compelling evidence to suggest that there was planning, that there was coordination, that this wasn't spontaneous, and that President Trump is responsible for this insurrection, that this was an attempted coup. And if his supporters and if he wants to have his day in court, then the best way for this to happen, as jarring as it might be for some people to see a former president on trial, is for the Justice Department to take this up and to start the criminal process of levying charges against the people who were directly involved. And then you will have the adversarial system that we're used to, where you have a prosecution present their case and you have the defense present their case.
Andra, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University in Atlanta. Ahead this hour, we hear from the head of ATI Forged Products, headquartered in Cutaway, as part of our ongoing C-suite conversations. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about being pregnant during the pandemic.
Over the last several years, many profound experiences that typically would be shared with loved ones were lost in the pandemic. Rachel Poston of Milwaukee experienced this when her husband wasn't allowed to come to any of her appointments during her pregnancy. Poston shares her story as part of the Pandemic Pregnancy Project, which is documenting the stories of families and their babies and how they've been affected by COVID-19.
We had a Zoom meeting with our friend group, and one of them was pregnant, and she's not feeling a connection because she's not showing yet and doesn't feel any movement. My husband was saying that he understood because he didn't feel that connection with our pregnancy. It really made me think. During my entire pregnancy in Milwaukee County at my clinic, I couldn't have a guest at any of my appointments. Disappointment is an understatement. I lost that opportunity to have that bond with my husband, experiencing these new milestones in our pregnancy, especially to hear her heartbeat. When he was not allowed in, it was isolating for him a little bit, so his perspective on my friend's lack of connection to her pregnancy didn't surprise me. He saw the anatomy scan through a very blurry FaceTime. The realization that I'm here in a clinic with only the ultrasound tech, hearing that I'm having a girl for the first time and we both wanted a girl, and being alone with a stranger, there were moments when it didn't feel as real as it could or complete. He and I got jealous because we heard of other people's partners being able to go to their appointments because they were at a different hospital or a different county with different restrictions. We were told that maybe if we went to another county, maybe my partner could come with me. Or even in Milwaukee, just switch OBs to a different hospital or a different network. It's like, why do I want to give up this OB who's known me for years, who I trust, who I love? Things are looking up. I'm at 30 weeks, although COVID is still rampant, and my OB tells me that my husband can go to the growth scan after I've already scheduled it. I didn't know this when I scheduled the growth scan. Maybe the schedulers forgot to tell me. They assumed I knew the rules had changed. After my OB tells me this, I call the schedulers to make sure this change was correct, because I don't want to bring my partner all the way downtown to find out he can't go inside. So I call and tell me, no, the rules changed, he can't come in. He could have come to your first ultrasound. When was your first ultrasound? My first ultrasound was in October, to which she says, oh no, he wouldn't have been allowed to come then. The rules have changed so much. I know these changes were out of their hand. It's like, why are you telling a pregnant woman who's coming in at 30 weeks that her husband could have been there for the first ultrasound, then to take it back, then to say he still can't come, and expect me to feel emotionally okay about this back and forth, given the circumstances are also out of my hands as well? I sat in a waiting room, I called my husband, and I told him, you can't come. He says, oh, it's fine, it's fine, it's not a big deal, it's not a big deal. I haven't been there for all of them. And I say a lot of different things, and finally knowing this conversation won't bring him, I cry. I'm sitting in the waiting room, waiting to go in for an ultrasound, and I see a couple come out, a wife and husband, going on their way. I remind myself, it's probably their first ultrasound. The rules have changed. That's great that he can go, that someone else can experience what I wasn't allowed to. My husband did get to hear her when I had a false alarm and thought my water broke. So at least for the final big moments, we made it work. The world continues. When our daughter was born, he was there when he put her on my chest, and I just looked at her and said, "You're going to be one bad." And my OB was shocked. I'm a part of reclaiming that word. And my husband was there to witness this moment. And after I'd done this amazing thing of giving birth, we felt bad.
Rachel Poston of Milwaukee shared her story of being pregnant during the pandemic. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to our C-suite conversations here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into the business climate in our state, talk with leaders who run companies that have deep roots here. ATI Forged Products threads a history through Cudahy in forging and machining, going back almost 120 years as it acquired Ladish in 2011. Working in that age-old practice of forging metal in a variety of finished products, now they bring to market high-strength components for jet engines, for deep-sea submersibles, for rotor hub parts for helicopters. Join in on manufacturing, on heavy machining in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. Jim Might is president of ATI Forged Products, which is headquartered in Cudahy. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you, Kate. Appreciate it.
Goodness. I was watching one of your old videos yesterday showing that hot forging process and the hammers slamming down on the metal, like blow by blow, shaping it inside this crazy hot furnace. I mean, can you take us inside your plant and explain some of these processes?
Yeah, that's perfect. And it's a great lead in. And it's very exciting what we do here in Cudahy and in Wisconsin. So really what we focus on is producing materials that can withstand the toughest conditions, as you mentioned, like the high temperature and jet engines or the aggressive environments in space. And we do that by transforming material at elevated temperatures through various forging processes. And our two key ones that we focus on is isothermal forging and super hot die forging. And those are really our superpowers in the industry. Probably one or two other companies in the world can do what we do. So we take that material, heat it at around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and forge it into complex shapes for our customers and enable them to achieve their greatest achievements. And that's our focus.
You know, as I watched, I was thinking about these people, these you know, these workers, but also as artisans in this process, and wondering just how does their technology prowess, how do their hands make all of this happen in forging?
Yeah, it's another great question, and it's really built on a large amount of experience. You know, over 40 years of world-class engineering and technical knowledge. As I mentioned, the isothermal forging and super hot die, very tightly controlled processes and machines that we've helped develop in the industry over time in order to produce the parts that we manufacture. So it's a continuous evolution. And we continue to focus on that as we grow. As we grow with the marketplace, we recently installed our fourth isothermal press in Cudahy, and we're bringing another press back online as we see the demand increase in jet engines.
Does that mean that you need to hire up more workers?
Yes, it does. You know, this year has been growth for us across our operations in Wisconsin. Year to date, we've hired around 80 individuals for our team. And we have openings for another 40. So if there's anybody interested out there, I recommend they go to atimaterials.com and look at the job openings that are out there for us.
You can even recruit while you're talking to us here. Go right. Go right ahead.
Drop that in there for sure.
Here's a question though. How do you secure these rare exotic metals or other materials that don't exist in Wisconsin?
So as part of being part of ATI, we're fortunate that we have an integrated supply chain. So our sister company in North Carolina produces the materials for us. The billet and material we get in as input materials produced in North Carolina. And then we look at, you know, how we make sure from a supply chain standpoint, we're protected, making sure we get the raw materials we need around the world and to support our production.
Some have called those exotic rare metals black gold because without them, all sorts of technology can't come to fruition, like even green technology, wind turbines and electric cars and solar panels. Do you worry about their scarcity and the job of extracting rare earth elements needed for the new technologies that you make?
I don't think we're worried about it. You know, one thing that we've done over the last several years and making sure we have taken the right actions and steps to safeguard our operations and to safeguard our company and looking at the different levers we can pull to make sure we have the right supply chain in place for the long term.
Supply chain has been such a huge headache for so many industries, so many companies. What has it been like for your business, for your company?
I think it's been a challenge, just like everyone else, facing some supply chain issues. But as I mentioned, we're well positioned, having an integrated supply of material, to support our forging processes. We've planned for the growth in aerospace and jet engines. Obviously we're excited that it's here and continues. So I think we're well positioned for that, going through the next several years. And we continue to, as I mentioned, continue to find the levers that we can pull to make sure we offset any challenges we face in the supply chain.
What you also need is energy to run these furnaces, to run this type of production. And we have talked about here on our show about the electric grid and energy sources. Do you think the state is adequately meeting your energy needs? What do you see there?
Yeah, I believe so, Kate. Things that we focus on, sustainability is definitely a core value for ATI. And one thing we've been working with is We Energies to try to figure out how we can reduce our energy use. In 2021, We Energies did provide us an award with an Energy Efficiency Excellence Award. We've really focused on how we can reduce our consumption by replacing around 7,000 light bulbs with LEDs. We've saved over 100,000 therms of natural gas and 6 million kilowatts hours of electricity. So it's been a key focus of ours. It's not just here in our plant, but we also think about the community. We had about 8 acres of unused land here in Cudahy, and we recently installed and partnered to install 7,000 solar panels, which helps to power around 700 homes in the local area.
Jim Might, president of ATI Forge Products, operating in locations worldwide, making parts for jet engines, as we've been talking about, the defense industry as well. Join in on complex manufacturing, specialty alloys, the future of machining in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, back in a minute with Jim Might and more from our CEO series on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on the business climate in Wisconsin today with the CEO of ATI Forged Products. This is a company with a history that traces back to its operations in Cudahy that started in the early 20th century forging camshafts for agricultural and construction implements. Today, a leader in the R&D of super alloys and specialty metal forging. Join in 800-642-1234. President Jim Might with us for about 9 more minutes. Jim, let's talk about the, you know, the size and power and the heat of these machines, as we talked about earlier, can make the work dangerous. What do safety regulators require for how often machines need to be checked and maintained? What is that like?
Yeah, so, you know, another core value for ATI is safety. And it's something we're focused on every day. You know, making sure that we continue a journey to get to a zero injury culture, right? That's where we want to get to. So every individual, every teammate comes in and leaves the same way every day. Very focused at how we do that, how we protect our team, making sure they're safe. And that includes our equipment and machines. So we're very focused at how we provide maintenance and review of those equipment. So each piece is on a set frequency where we perform the proper maintenance and safety checks, be it daily, monthly, or quarterly.
How are workers trained on these machines and on the operations that not only shape your culture, but shape the metal that they're making?
So it depends on the operation and the process, but there is, you know, defined and standards from a training standpoint. Some of it can be upwards of, you know, 1500 hours of training before they're a full-time operator or a full-time teammate on that process. So significant amount of training to make sure that the operators are doing it properly and doing it safely, making sure that we're producing the high quality parts that we need to support our customers with. And we have a terrific team to do that every single day.
What about federal oversight? President Biden last year ordered OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, to update its pandemic guidance and have more uniformity in keeping workers safe on the job. I'm curious, how would you characterize federal enforcement of workplace safety standards in the inspections you've been a part of?
You know, I think from our perspective, it's a partnership. It's something, you know, as we think about our journey from a safety standpoint and building that zero injury culture, it's another set of eyes that can help us move along that journey. You know, we're open to having, you know, those set of eyes come in and see what we don't see every day, or help us see new things and new opportunities to continue to improve, to make sure we do keep our employees safe. That's our focus. And as I mentioned, that's a core value to us. So we look for those opportunities to improve and get better.
I want to talk here about workforce, because you said you do have dozens of job openings. And last month we talked with Nick Pinchuk, who is the president and CEO of Snap-on. That's the, you know, the Kenosha-based company that manufactures tools and equipment. And he talked about U.S. manufacturers struggling to find workers.
Right now there are 900,000 manufacturing jobs open. And there are two reasons for that. We don't have the skills, and two, manufacturing and other technical careers have a PR problem. People view them as what other people's kids do.
How do you think the industry could get more workers in the door?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's, you know, a very tight market that we're in. I think for us, you know, our mission is to make sure we're an employer of choice. We want to make sure we're moving fast to hire and working very hard to attract the best candidates at every level. You know, part of that is making sure we have an offer of a competitive pay, good benefits, and opportunities for growth. You know, want to make sure it's not just a job, it's really focused at a career. And our focus, you know, is not just looking at what's in the market today, but making sure we're trying to drive down into high schools and middle schools in our local communities so that they can understand the careers that are available. Because there are great careers within our shops, in our facilities within ATI. And we want to make sure we're pulling that lever to continue to support our growth that we need.
But how do you shake the stereotypes then, that manufacturing is dirty work, it's someone else's work, and this push for kids to go toward these four-year schools?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is, you know, some of that PR, getting into middle schools and high schools, talking to the students and the kids, and also to the parents. You know, I'm a strong advocate that, you know, within our communities, we have great manufacturing jobs here in Cudahy and throughout Wisconsin. And then, you know, I think we have to tie it to the products that we make. You know, the products that we're providing and producing here, people rely on every day. And they're in the most challenging and extraordinary conditions. Every time you fly on an airplane, there's parts that are produced in Wisconsin on the jet engine, parts that are produced in Cudahy. And they're cutting edge, right? And you mentioned the super alloys and the titanium alloys that we produce. There's only a few competitors in the world that can do that. And we're doing it right here and providing something that everybody relies on every single day.
Jim Might with us, president of ATI Forge Products, headquartered in Cudahy, part of our series of conversations with Wisconsin's major corporate leaders. You can join in 800-642-1234. ATI, you know, employs about 750 people in Wisconsin. Correct me there if that's not right. You know, this is engineers and operators and support staff, highly skilled in material science. When you look at the rising, skyrocketing inflation and the low unemployment, the dozens of openings, is there pressure for you to raise wages to stay competitive in manufacturing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that, you know, we want to make sure we are competitive from a wage and compensation standpoint and also a benefit standpoint. And we look at what the market has, and we want to make sure we're trying to stay ahead of that. And comparing, you know, not just here in Wisconsin, but throughout our other operations in the U.S. of how we can do that. But it's not just all about wage. I mean, that's an important part, but we want to make sure, as I mentioned, that it's about a career. And it's long-term growth for individuals within ATI.
We have less than a minute left, but what could Wisconsin do to improve the business climate for manufacturers here?
I think from our perspective, we have a good partnership with Wisconsin. You know, you mentioned we've been here for almost 120 years. We're proud to be part of the Wisconsin community, and we look for opportunities to grow. And what we've been successful with is really working with the MMAC, which is the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, along with the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, WEDC, to understand, you know, how we can work together and partner to support our growth. We've been very successful over the last several years of investing in Wisconsin, expanding our footprint in Appleton and a few other areas. And they've been a supportive partner with that. So I think you have to find the right partnerships to support the growth that we need and continue to find those opportunities.
Jim, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome very much, Kate. Thank you.
Jim Might is president of ATI Forge Products that is based in Cudahy. All summer long, we're having a series of conversations with leaders from Wisconsin's largest employers as we check in with the C-suites of companies that are deeply invested in our state. You can find these programs, back conversations, WPR.org/mornings. Connect with me on LinkedIn to further the conversation. I'm listed under my name, Kate Archer Kent. This is The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.